We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum the colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome, and thanks for joining us on this special live edition of The Tightrope. We're here for the post-presidential debate after party, and we're really delighted to have you here. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my co-host and dear friend, Dr. Cornel West. We are delighted to have three special guests over the next hour, but before they come through, I'm hoping to chat with Dr. West a little bit about this debate. But let me give you a little bit of a teaser about who's coming, and then we'll have a dialogue. So we're going to find out what's happening on the ground in Pennsylvania from the Commonwealth Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. He's a Democratic Socialist and early endorser of Bernie Sanders for president. Then we'll have a cross-generational conversation with the National Press Secretary of Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign, Breonna Joy Gray, along with veteran political strategist Dr. Ron Daniels. Unfortunately, Georgia State Senator Nkemah Williams, who was scheduled to join us, had a death in the family, so our condolences go out to her and her family. We're sorry she can't be here, but we welcome her anytime. And she's set to take John Lewis's seat in Congress, so we will hopefully be able to talk with her then. But before we bring out these distinguished and politically savvy people, I want to try to decompress a little bit with Dr. West on what just happened. I mean, what actually just happened, Brother West? I mean, you know, I do like the muted mic. Let me just start by saying it was a great joy to see Trump's mouth moving, but nothing actually being said.
Well, I'm so glad you're wearing your beautiful blue today, because this is a very, very pathetic situation. The level of decrepitude and just outright decay in the public life of the empire is just it's just so undeniable. It really is. It's very sad, you know, in so many ways. But we got to always work with what we got, you know. We black folk, we freedom fighters, we got to work with what we got, no matter what. But we have to be unflinchingly honest in terms of what we up against. And it was it was a sad spectacle. But what was your take, my dear sister?
Well, you know, I just was so struck yet again by the assertion after assertion that made it impossible to actually tell fact from fiction.
Right.
It was just a spectacle of, he didn't do this, he had this many years, or don't listen to him, he's lying. I mean, it was a classic kind of content-free debate, just position after position, because there was no agreement on facts, you would just not be able to tell where any of the information came from. And that's not having anything to do with the content of the positions, which is a whole nother issue that we'll get back to, I'm sure. But just the form of that relationship, right, between fact and response. Go ahead, Cornel. Yeah.
No, but I mean, it's a neo-fascist strategy. You see, if you just beat people down by lies and say them over and over and over and over again, then any attempt to get at the truth has very little weight. So it's both a will to power on the one hand, but it's a form of disempowering any of the counter voices. And we already got milquetoast journalists who have rarely told the truth anyways. So they just get rimshotted over, and he just continually lie, and the lies hide the crimes. And so he knew that. Now, of course, this time it was different than last time in the sense that he couldn't just completely take over. But he still was out of line oftentimes, And Biden's there, you know, he's trying to respond, and he's got his own lies and his own way. But, I mean, he's better than Trump in so many ways, no doubt. But still, you know, you look at these two folk and you say to yourself, so this is the best that America could do in 2020 when it comes to leadership at the highest level. You know, what a sign and signal to fellow citizens, and especially the younger generation. That's the thing that I'm sad about.
Yeah. That's so what did you think about their answers? Because I felt like Kristen Welker asked a specific question, and Biden more generally answered the direct question he was being asked. Trump didn't even try to answer the questions that were, so, you know, what would you say to this person? You know, Biden would say, I would say this, or I would do that. Trump very rarely ever directly answered the question, and he's a master of changing the actual focus of the conversation in a way that was pretty nuanced. I mean, it was tragically impressive in that regard. And nobody held him to that. Although, wait, one other thing I wanted to ask you, what did you think of the moderator in this case compared to our last,
She was better than the last one, and she was able to hold on to talking about, you know, the legacies of white supremacy a little bit better. She didn't use that language, but she came back to race more than the first one. So she wanted to be, in some sense, persistent in that way. But Trump was still able to use his strategy of, as you say, just not answering the question. She asked the question, what do you think about a black sister like you, black brother like me, sitting down and talking to our kids vis-a-vis a police department that would use arbitrary power and brutality against them?
Right.
And he moves right into, I'm the least racist president. I'm the least racist person in the room. I've done more for black folk than Abraham Lincoln, as if FLBJ and any other of these presidents didn't do that much for black folk, which is a lie. LBJ made his contribution in a serious way. But it just goes uncontested. I mean, he just says it enough times that people just say, oh, my God, maybe he got a point. Maybe he got something. And he has no sense of any countervailing forces coming at him directly. I mean, there was one moment I thought that Brother Biden hit Brother Trump hard, which was when they talked about the kids in the cages.
Oh, yes.
And I noticed even Trump kind of backed up. Because, I mean, he's a gangster and a bully. You see, a gangster and a bully, you got to hit him hard. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you got to hit him below the belt just to let him know he's always under the belt. I can go there, too, if I have to, but I don't want to. But Biden did that one time, and Trump kind of pulled back. And that was the only time where I think Trump really felt a certain kind of punch.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. I wanted to just add a little bit of texture to your point about how he avoided responding to the what would you say to black parents who give the talk to their kids. He didn't actually address black families at all. He went to his, handful of, HBCU representatives who come to the White House, who are just happy to come to the White House and, get money that Obama made them ask for every year. And I've given them for 10 years and we're such good friends. You know, who knows if they're going to, maybe they won't come back because I've given them so much money. This just complete evasion of the question of the police, and he got away with it. There was literally no explanation for what he would tell parents who have to give this talk. He's able to basically normalize the reality of white supremacy by not denying it and not answering it at the same time, by saying I pay off people or I have people who like me who happen to be black, and that's supposed to answer this question about what black families have to do on the daily.
But see, the journalist of Biden should have said, so you said that. What would you say to the black parents? What would you say to Mr. Johnson? What would you say to Mrs. Smith? What are they going to say to Jamal and Shanique? What are they going to say to Wes's children? What are you going to say to Mr. Rose's children? I mean, Biden himself could come back and say, answer that question, man. I did.
Right.
You got to continually push these gangsters when it comes to them sidestepping all, because they've been doing that their whole lives. So So they normalize it, they routinize it, they naturalize it, and act that's the only way of being in the world. No, this is not the only way of being in the world, man.
It sure is.
You're going to be accountable at least in one instant in your life.
Right, right, yeah. And, you know, that I really like your point about his response to the kids, Biden's response to the kids at the border being intentionally separated as a deterrent. And I just want to remind our viewers that, you know, it's one thing to detain people and send them back home. It's a whole nother thing to separate babies and children from their families for years. And the tremendous trauma that produces, and just the brutality of that as a policy. I thought Biden did a very, very good job.
That's true.
Just one last thing. Remember when Trump said, you know, they're very clean. They're being well treated.
Oh,
the kids are fine. They're clean.
Yeah,
I'm like, what are they? You know, little animals? What do you mean they're clean? Are they? I mean, the trauma is just completely erased. He can't imagine it. He won't even voice it.
There's no empathy, no sympathy. And you say, won't you put your son down there for a while? See how clean it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
No, it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
But we got to keep fighting. You know, we're going to keep telling the truth. We're going to keep bearing witness. And,
of course, the wonderful folk
on the show today, they're still bearing witness. They still swinging. They still fighting. So that's a beautiful thing.
They are. And we're happy to have them with us because we need all the fighters on our team we can get.
I'd love to welcome
our first guest, John Fetterman, who's here, Lieutenant Governor. Hey there. How are you, John?
How are you?
Oh, you know, we're hanging on. We're on the tightrope doing our best over here. But we're thrilled to have you. Tell us what you thought.
How you doing, my brother? Good to see you. Good to see you, man.
Hello. Sure. Well, I mean, I was sitting here listening to what you guys were saying about the debate. And you know, I mean, you obviously didn't hear anything that would change your views on either the vice president or Mr. Trump. And I certainly didn't either. I think that the key takeaway is that we have the clearest choice in my lifetime politically and where in the direction that we're going in. And you know, the president, I mean, if you, and I don't know how anybody could necessarily like the last 4 years or think we want more of it, but you have a choice of if you like the last 4 years, you have your choice. And then if you want a different departure and you want a different outcome, you have the vice president. And I don't think that it would have changed anyone's outlook one way or the other, quite frankly, in the debate. And we are where we are, and we're well under 2 weeks left until the most consequential election of our lives. I think that's, I don't think there was a case made breaking from either camp, quite frankly, if you weren't already there for the debate.
Right, right. So what do you think? I mean, there's no question I'm sure there weren't just overwhelming, oh, well, I'm going to switch sides and vote for the other candidate. I think you're right about that. But I'm interested in also some on the ground skirmishes that might produce some outcomes that could be significant. And I'm wondering why you think that Pennsylvania might be the sort of ground zero for the tipping point for who wins, given the kinds of polarization that we already have.
Well, because Pennsylvania, again, I have my opinions, but, you know, who cares what I think? But I think if you think what do the campaigns think? Well, the president has been in Pennsylvania. I've lost count. The vice president has been in Pennsylvania the same number of times, if not more. In fact, they have more visits planned already. The vice president is coming back to Pennsylvania. He's going to Luzerne County. He's going to Bucks County. And the president is going to Bucks County, and I think also one other stop. So I've lost track of the number of times both of them have come to Pennsylvania. So regardless of what I think, and I've always said this, but both campaigns clearly think that this race will hinge on Pennsylvania. And without a doubt, if the president doesn't win Pennsylvania, he has no realistic mathematical path to 270, and Joe Biden is our next president. And with respect to Pennsylvania picking the president, I've long held that view. Both campaigns seem to have embraced that by the sheer amount of resources and time that they've expended on the state. And they are desperate to make their case here in Pennsylvania. But I think, you know, I've seen the polls, obviously. I've talked to a lot of voters. I'm on the ground here. I think the vice president is uniquely positioned to carry Pennsylvania. That being said, I would never underestimate the popularity of Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. And I have always adhered to this philosophy of you need to run like you're 5 points down and not cede a single vote and go until the polls are closed, because there's a different controversy every day. There's a different lawsuit. There's a different judgment. And the noise and the chaos is unlike anything I've certainly seen in my lifetime. And we just have to hold tight and make sure we deliver Pennsylvania, because I believe the Pennsylvania will ultimately pick a president.
No, I was blessed to work with my dear brother Anthony down there in the Black Congressional Caucus just this past week. It was a kind of a get out to vote effort. And of course, it was nonpartisan in the sense that we want people to vote, but we all have our own particular tilt as to which way we headed. But when you say that people are not interested in your opinion, we are highly interested in your opinion. Do you think that there's evidence that it's going to go one way or the other, or is it still way up in the air? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I thank you for saying that, Dr. Ross. No, I mean, in terms of my opinion, I've always said that Pennsylvania is going to pick the president. And it's like, well, I'm saying that, well, what are the vice president and what are the Trump campaign say? Well, it's like, judging by the sheer number of visits, they agree with me. So I think And I'm actually very encouraged what I see on the ground. As you know, former President Obama came to Philadelphia just yesterday. And that's deploying like some heavy
artillery.
artillery. That's a great idea. And that is part of what I'm encouraged is like it's a two-pronged outreach. You have former President Obama in Philadelphia that is going to generate a lot of excitement and a lot of interest, and it'll bring out turnout in Philadelphia, creating a lot of excitement, really making the case for Vice President Biden. But then you also have Vice President Biden going to these smaller counties, which I believe are really one of the key things in Pennsylvania. And he went to Cambria County, Erie County. He's going to Bucks County. He's going to Luzerne County. He's making the cases in these smaller counties. The way you eliminate Donald Trump's ability to win Pennsylvania is that you damage and diminish his margins in these small counties. Donald Trump created unprecedented margins in small counties all across Pennsylvania, and each one small county isn't necessarily going to be a meaningful vote total. But if you stack it on 55 other counties, as he did in 2016, he created a 45,000 vote margin, which ultimately carried him to victory. And if you dent those margins the way the vice president's strategy seems to be, you eliminate any chance for Donald Trump to win Pennsylvania, therefore cutting off his path to 270. And the fact that they're doing both this year, as opposed to Secretary Clinton just created a lot of energy and rallies in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, she didn't venture outside those two urban areas. And that ultimately, I believe, cost her Pennsylvania, which ultimately cost her the presidency.
Right. Many of us are old enough to remember, and certainly all three of us are, the 2000 Florida recount. And all of those young white boys in their blue Oxford shirts successfully disrupting the recount process. What do you imagine will be the context for this kind of challenge now? Do you think that, is there a plan to prevent this kind of disruption of recounts from any group of people, no matter what the vote is moving toward? But, you know, are there plans that are responsive to this memory and other ones like it?
Sure. Well, I want everyone on this watching to understand that voting in Pennsylvania is safe, is secure, and true, and that we will be able to deliver a result that will reflect the true democratic will of Pennsylvania's voters. That's a fact. Our vote by mail system is new, but it worked without a single instance of fraud during the June primary, and we are. It's going actually very well and smoothly. I mean, there's minor incidents, but when you're talking with millions and millions and millions of ballots, of course, there's going to be isolated incidents. And in every case, the system has worked and the errors have been detected. Ballots have been reissued. There hasn't been any double voting. There hasn't been any instances of any evidence of actual fraud. So this idea that voting in Pennsylvania or any of these states, I'm telling people to trust the United States Postal Service, that it's going smoothly. It's all about fomenting chaos, and the other side wants to foment chaos to actually undermine the Democrats' confidence in vote by mail and dropping their ballot. So and I tell people, just don't listen to the noise, just vote. It's really that simple. And in terms of any legal challenges or whatever, you know, they can file whatever cases that they want. The bottom line is that it's going to come down to a result that is unlikely going to be 536 votes and swinging chads or anything like that. I mean, we're not going to have a scene like that in Pennsylvania. I think the vice president will prevail. I would never take Donald Trump and not take him very seriously in Pennsylvania, but there is no evidence that the voting systems or any of these other things are going to not work and deliver it. We may not deliver a final vote total election night at 11 o'clock when everyone would like that or expect that, simply because the Republicans in the state legislature refuse to allow early canvassing. Right now, the law in Pennsylvania is that the earliest point canvassing can begin is 7 a.m. on election day. So you're going to have roughly, 2.7, 2.8 million ballots that are going to need to be counted at some point that day. So that's going to take some time. But we will be delivering our results just as quickly as possible.
Right.
And what should the Democratic Party do if Trump loses and refuses to leave?
I don't really think that scenario would necessarily play out. I think you already see the Republicans distancing themselves to some from the president and some of his views. I mean, let's be honest. He's going to appoint Amy Barrett to the Supreme Court. They're going to lock in that conservative majority going forward. Mm-hmm. And for them, I think that's all that they really have left in this, to be quite frank. They this understanding that they have that 6-3 majority. And, you know, I'm committed to making sure that the election doesn't end up in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court. And I based on what I've seen and things are on the ground, I do feel good. But I'm also, you know, I think if you look at 2020, I don't think anyone's bingo card, you know, picked up all the things that have happened, whether it was the pandemic or whether it was the George Floyd aftermath and the reckoning, whether it was the president himself contracting COVID, whether it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing away. I mean, there's just been so much churn and there's a level of exhaustion. And I think people are only responding to this one core question, and that is, do we like the last 4 years, or do we want a different direction? And I think there's core blocks of voters in my state, at least, that are saying, you know what, I want a different direction. And whether the vice president was your pick during the primary or he is your dream candidate is irrelevant at this point. It's like, we know what Donald Trump has been for this country, and we know we need a different direction, and we believe that Vice President Biden is that direction. And one thing that is all but absent in on the ground here in Pennsylvania that was not in 2016 was trying to urge the most progressive members of our party and the wing of our party to support the vice president. I think there is no sense of collective, well, they're all the same, or I'm going to sit this out. I think everybody at this point understands what's at stake.
Right, right. So speaking of the need to have every vote counted, I'm under the impression that you won the race for mayor of Braddock by one vote. First
Correct.
Of all,
and
is this true? First
yes,
of all.
Yes, it is. It was actually a provisional ballot. And a provisional ballot's been in the news here in Pennsylvania, in that if you have a mail-in ballot, you registered to vote by mail, and you just show up without your ballot, you have to cast a provisional ballot. It's something that most people, quite frankly, are unaware of. A provisional ballot is a fail-safe of the electoral system where if they cannot allow you to vote for a reason, you have the right to demand a provisional ballot and cast, and then they will go and retroactively review to make sure that you are, in fact, registered to vote. And that's the circumstance here that I hope doesn't come to pass, and I don't think it will,
right.
that people are well, I don't want to vote by mail anymore. I want to show up, but you shouldn't do that.
Right. I see. And so before we let you go, because we have short time and I would love to talk longer, but you have some very famous tattoos that are related to your years as mayor of Braddock. And I raise them not just because it's interesting to me, but also because it speaks to this question of our emotional attachment and leadership of our communities. There's been so much gap between our sort of public figures and their relationship to the people that they're serving. And from what I understand, your tattoos really speak to a real bond and a history. Can you share a little bit of that with us?
Of course. The one on my arm here is Braddock's zip code 15104. I'm having trouble yet. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, Braddock, there we go. Yeah. Okay.
And then on this arm is dates of where we have lost lives in our community to gun violence during my time as mayor. And it's something that I have always internalized. And just speaks to at least, you know, the loss and the horror of what violence and the lives that's been taken. I, you know, literally kind of wear it on my sleeve, so to speak.
Yeah. More than on your sleeve. Yeah.
If every distinguished graduate of the Kennedy School at Harvard had your kind of tattoos and your kind of sensitivity, it'd be a different kind of world, my brother.
Thank you. Well, and there's a rumor, unconfirmed, that Senator Sanders will actually be coming to our neck of the woods at some point in the next couple of days to campaign for the vice president. I can't confirm that, but I've heard some stuff. So I think there's reason to be optimistic here on the ground here in Pennsylvania. Truly, that doesn't mean that we don't have to go like heck over these last 10 or 11 days. And flipping the state house and the state senate in Pennsylvania here would be a game changer for us. And there's a lot of enthusiasm around that. So, but thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Delighted. Delighted to have you. And thank you for joining us. And good luck down there over the next few weeks. And we'll keep our eye on the prize and remember that basically for all intent and purposes, we're always 5 to 10 points down until it's all counted. So
that's how I've always believed it. So thank you.
No, I
thank
like that. I like so that strategy.
True. That's
yes,
true.
Indeed.
Thank
Never
you so
count
much.
Your chicken.
Thank you so great.
So we're welcome back on the tightrope anytime. Thank you so much for joining us and we hope to see you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Good night. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Now, John.
Be safe. Stay strong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you really get the sense this is a war of position.
And the sense of Antonio Gramsci, we got a serious war on the ground. It's nonviolent. It could spill over. You never know. But he's nonviolent, and yet it's still up in the air. Though, I mean, it's just hard to believe that with so many fellow citizens could still opt for the Trump that we saw tonight. The Trump that we see every week, the Trump that's been in place for 3.5 years, that says something about the country, I tell you. It says something about the country.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable when you think about it. I mean, it's something he knows what he's tapping into with the combination of moves and the language. It's almost as if there's this pining for an imaginary past that even though he's completely seemingly been unable to deliver is nonetheless the sort of symbol of, and it's like a swan song, you know, for an imaginary past that is about a combination of privileges and a combination of economic security, relatively speaking. But it's completely disassociated from the policies that gave those opportunities, Medicare, Social Security, so on and so forth. Those things become demonized as socialist this and socialist that. And that those are the publicly funded, you know, education. And yet it just doesn't matter. You know, it just doesn't seem to matter.
Without the black and brown folk, he would win by a majority.
Oh, Lord, have mercy.
If black and brown folk just disappeared on November 3rd, Trump would be breakdancing all the way through the White House. You see what I mean? So that That's the kind of country we live in, and that's not all white brothers and sisters, but
no, but they're enough.
We have to be very honest in terms of, and every person who votes for him is not a racist. They know he's racist, but they themselves just don't have an alternative, don't feel they have an alternative, and they want to be associated with a strong man, and that's how neo-fascism is able to really take off and flower and flourish, you see. Mm-hmm. But it's that kind of reality we have to just be honest about, even as we continue to fight for truth and justice.
Yeah, yeah. Before we bring on our next two guests, which I'm really excited to speak with and to meet, you know, what you're saying reminds me of something that Richard Rorty said about, you know, what globalization was going to eventually generate, which was precisely what has happened. You know, this kind of evisceration and then this identification of a strong man and the focus on believing that. I mean, that was years and years ago he said that.
That's true. That's very, very true.
And here we are. So, you know, basically listen to philosophers. That's the answer.
Just kidding.
All right. Well, I know we don't have a lot of time, so we're going to move forward. You know, I can talk with you forever. But we have two fantastic people who I'm really delighted to bring on. We have Breonna Joy Gray and Ron Daniels. Breonna Joy Gray was the national press secretary for the Bernie Sanders 220 campaign, and Ron Daniels, a veteran social and political activist and former candidate for the United States, among many other things for both of you. Thank you both so much for joining us on The Tightrope.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We got two towering freedom fighters and truth tellers right here. Daniels, go back. He's a marathoner in the struggle for freedom here in Haiti, Africa, all around the world. And this sister here, I'm telling you, got the fire too. So it's a blessing to have you on, both of you.
Thank you very much, Professor West.
How are you both doing in the wake of this latest debate? Is it just something that just washes over you, like we've been here, done this, we don't really care what happened tonight? Was there anything that you found particularly troubling or curious or something you want to make sure that our listeners and viewers, you know, really keep in mind? Let's start with you, Breonna.
Well, to start on a positive note, I do feel like Joe Biden gave one of his better performances. He came out strong. He was very responsive to the questions and specific in a way that at times is lacking, and which can give him a kind of weakness, even though he has the rhetorical and ethical upper hand in most of these exchanges. So he did well tonight. Unfortunately, there were some of these retread moments of stepping on what are vulnerable sore spots for progressive voters who, of course, Joe Biden does need to maintain the kind of coalition that you need to assuredly beat Donald Trump. So there was this doubling down of rejecting a fracking ban, which is a mixed issue in Pennsylvania, one that I spoke to a Pennsylvania voter about recently on our podcast on today's episode, the young Black man who asked Joe Biden a question at last week's town hall, who felt like the worst issue for Joe Biden was that he continues to kind of thumb his nose at the environmental concerns of a lot of young voters and the core Democrats. And I was disappointed to see that he didn't evolve on his response to the fracking debate in this debate. But otherwise, I thought he was strong.
Brother Daniels, did you have any thoughts about this debate?
No, I was very encouraged, frankly, by the debate tonight. And I take it from the long view of, as the Lieutenant Governor Fetterman said, this is the most consequential election in recent history. And if that is the case, then it seems to me that there's a clear choice between what Spike Lee has dubbed the Orange Man or the Agent Orange, and between Joe Biden. And so for me, it's important to strike kind of an optimistic tone, simply because we want, at the end of the day, people to march on ballot boxes as never before. Now, is Biden a perfect candidate? He certainly is not. I mean, I support Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was the candidate I would have liked to have been the candidate. I think he could actually win. That's my view. He did not. But on the other hand, the gulf, and I want to be clear about this, the gulf between Biden and Sanders Biden and the Orange Man is enormous. It is not even close. And so it seems to me my position is, and my responsibility is, to say Biden is clearly the better choice. And I heard some discussion about content. There was some content today. There's a discussion about healthcare, right? I would prefer single payer. Biden wants a public option. Trump wants no option. I mean, it's clear. I mean, so we need to be talking about that. We know that beyond this election, we have a tremendous challenge in order to push Biden to do better and to be stronger. But it does give on the key questions of life for human beings and what they're dealing with. You know, the living wage, clear. The whole question of voting rights, labor rights, immigration. And while I too, you know, I cringe when he talks about fracking, I cringe when he, you know, refuses to embrace the New Deal, the Green New Deal, still his environmental policies and what he's advocating is miles beyond what Trump is talking about. So my takeaway is we need to march on ballot boxes. I would, and I'm, by the way, I'm from Pittsburgh, so I know Braddock and where Braddock is and so forth. And I guess I would, while I want to court these white working class voters, I'm down with that. But Professor West, you also hit on it. Black and brown people, and I'm going to deal with black people. That's why Reverend Jesse Jackson was so brilliant. He talks about rocks just laying on the ground. We need to activate the massive numbers of black folks, including young people out there, who Sister Greg will be kind of turned off because they hear things that step on what they believe in. But we have to be bold enough and strong enough to understand that in the context of where we're going, we got to put that aside. We need to march on ballot box. I want to see a black led rainbow wave drive up a huge popular vote and a huge Senate majority and House majority. Because I also want to see reparations pass. You understand? And we are working on, we have reparations like it's never been before. 160 people who are now sponsors, a bill in the House of a bill in the Senate. And we want young people to know that that's being supported by the Democratic leadership. So let's march on ballot boxes. Let's eradicate Agent Orange and roll up our sleeves and fight for a more transformative politics on the other side.
You know, I agree with much of what you said, but my concern is that the issue with young voters, the issue with non-voters, the issue with voters who are those proverbial rocks in the ground, isn't that they misunderstand the gulf between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, or that they are indifferent to the real material existential harms that Donald Trump presents. And I think that sometimes characterizing the motivations of non-voters in that way elides the truth, which is that many voters, whether or not you agree with them, whether or not you personally would have that kind of emotional response, feel like it is the job of Democrats to earn their vote, of either party to earn their vote. And at a certain point, if people feel sufficiently disrespected by the people they're supposed to be voting for, no matter what they think the material returns are going to be, they won't put themselves at personal risk and stand in a line or take the time out of their day where they're dealing with unprecedented economic and health crisis to vote. And if we are truly interested in ensuring that Joe Biden wins, I think the question becomes, isn't it incumbent on Joe Biden to frame his pitch to the American voters in a way that shores up enthusiasm among his base, at least as much as he's endeavoring to shore up enthusiasm among Republicans, these never Trump voters, these John Kasich types, who he is going so far as to extend the olive branch of a spot in his administration, at the same time that he insists over and over again that he's not for the Green New Deal, a Green New Deal which, by the way, is popular with the majority of voters, that he is for fracking which is unpopular in Pennsylvania, which a majority of Pennsylvania voters actually disapprove of, right? Why is it that voters are constantly being harangued to ignore the worst of Joe Biden, as opposed to putting pressure on Joe Biden to rising to what is being asked of him in this moment, and in doing so, actually bolster his electoral chances at the same time that he does a better job of making our world a better place, and both when it comes to the environment, the existential crisis of our time, and these more pressing, frankly, personal economic problems that Americans are facing as a result of the COVID epidemic.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And my response would be that fortunately, the vast majority of Black people are pragmatic. The vast majority of Black people already made their mind up because they understand that this is not theory. This is about serious praxis on the ground. And I've outlined here, I have 13 different issues which in which there's a vast difference. It's not even close between Biden and Trump. Now, so it seems to me that my responsibility is to say, look, in any campaign, we line up the issues and say, where do people stand on these life and death, bread and butter issues that do matter in people's lives? And my responsibility is to encourage people to look at these items, look at them, and to move forward. And so, look, I said before, I would articulate some things differently, right? But on the other hand, my responsibility as a leader, from my perspective, is to understand the moment. And we are in a dangerous moment. And in a dangerous moment like this, you know, we have to clearly articulate what the better choice is. And then we know that on the other side, we have the ability to encourage people to do better. So my responsibility for those who feel like they're disrespected is to say, yeah, you're disrespected when somebody tells you can't have healthcare. You're disrespected when there are issue after issue, which the Democratic Party is standing for, that I have to, if Biden doesn't say it, I have to say it. He has a lift every voice agenda, which I wish he would talk about. Frankly, I wish Bernie Sanders had talked more about Black issues than he did not. But that didn't stop me from pushing for Bernie Sanders because he had a class analysis and sort of ignored in a public way the issue of race. Because I knew that Bernie Sanders, from my perspective, was clearly still the better candidate without question. So that's just the way I look at it, you know,
the issue for me, though, is how do we respect the people enough to tell them the truth? And then allow them to lift their voices and vote in the best of their judgment.
We ain't gonna lie about Biden.
I'm not lying
about Biden. We can say that.
Supporting death squads in Haiti, AFRICOM on the African continent, mass incarceration, Wall Street friendly.
Just tell them all of that.
Look, we're gonna tell. We want y'all to know this is what it is to be a neo-Nazi. Here's the neo-fascist. Here's the neo-fascist. Here's the neoliberal. Now, y'all, make your own decision. Now, see, for me, any brothers and sisters who say, I'm still not convinced for Biden, I can understand that.
I don't have a problem with that. Professor West, you know that this is an existential threat. Within any power structure, even if it's a neo-fascist one, there are tendencies that one may be the playing ground may be more favorable for you to organize on than another, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that as a professor. And so the whole question is there are always tough choices we have to make. And absolutely. In this scenario, we have to make tough choices. So if I tell them all of that, the one thing I know for sure is Trump would do all of that and worse.
Brianna, if I could just jump in on you on the other side with you for a second, because I mean, look, I come from a very similar generation where you just are super like pragmatic, and I have very low expectations that anybody's ever going to respect anything I say or vote about in the United States of America. So I'm kind of already giving that up, but at the same time. Every election feels very consequential. And young people, I think, are frustrated by the feeling that they don't know when it's ever going to stop. That is to say,
exactly.
At what point is it not going to be that we're making this sacrifice and we're still going to jail and we're still getting killed and we're still so on and so forth. Now, I'm going to vote for Biden. This, you know, there's no question about that. I don't believe letting that feeling, in fact, that I'm expressing solidarity with drive this decision I'm going to make. But I can understand this very strong feeling that it's a never-ending sacrifice. It's a never-ending context where we're being ignored, where those considerations are not being taken into account. And and the expectation that we should matter enough to be taken seriously doesn't come up enough. Now, again, I can argue against the point I just made, but I think that's a legitimate point. And I mean, I'll turn it over to you, Brianna, to pipe in here, but I just wanted to get in on that.
I think that's exactly right. And when I bring up these kinds of things, when I say, you know, every 4 years we're told this is the worst crisis, this is the most important election of our lives. And my point is not to disagree with that. It's to say that it's true. And why is it that every 4 years we seem to get worse and worse candidates, Republican candidates that are more right-wing, more neo-fascist than any that we've seen before? And I believe that there is a relationship between this impulse to vote blue no matter who and do harm reduction, which has solid ethical, reasons to back it, right? I'm not saying that the people who are doing that aren't coming from a place of genuine desire to have good outcomes for people who are existing right now. But I think it's really naive not to look at the long-term consequences of that. And when we talk about the extent to which the Democratic Party is reliant on our votes, I don't think of that with optimism. I don't think that that is a good thing. What has happened is that we are a captured community. Our votes are completely captured and therefore uncorded. When you look at the extent to which there is outreach going on to moderate Republicans, there's outreach going on to straight up people that we think are right wingers. When we look at the panelists on MSNBC and we have Bush's comms woman holding down the 8 o'clock hour or whatever it is, prime time, you have to start asking questions about whether or not the constant push for us to silence our criticisms, to diminish the enormous gulfs and weaknesses in candidates like Joe Biden, undermines the bigger movement that we have, and whether or not we need to start talking specifically, if you want young people to vote, talking specifically about what strategies we are going to implement to guarantee that we are not in this exact same place 4 or 3.5 years from now. And I think that part of that conversation has to be about whether we are willing as a community, as other kinds of organized groups and smaller subsets, whether you want to put pressure in swing states or what have you, whether or not we can start talking about withholding one's vote at any point as part of a broader organizational strategy.
Right. Well, I spent a little time doing that. Absolutely. I ran as an independent candidate for president of the United States in 1992. Understand? So I know a thing or two about these conversations, right? So I've studied them long and hard. But every moment is different. And that's where, he's the grand professor. I'm a little smaller professor. I'm only a...
No.
But what I say to my students is this. Yes, we say that every one of these elections is consequential. It's the most whatever. But I dare say that any analysis that we would do of the most recent elections clearly says that this is, in the history of these United States of America, one of its most dangerous moments. And so in that moment, even though I wish it were otherwise, that we have to therefore counter that and overcome that. Now, we also have to do organizing. That's what I do. I'm a intellectual, an action-oriented theorist. That's why I ran as an independent candidate for president. That's why we did something called Campaign for New Tomorrow. That's why right now I actually support the Working Families Party. I think it has a great potential because of its alliance with the Movement for Black Lives to really articulate a new kind of party. I am not wed to the Democratic Party. It's really not to me about the Democrats and Republicans. It's about ideology. And to me, on the liberal progressive spectrum, there is a huge gulf between, again, a Trump and a Biden. He is on the liberal progressive side of things. Now, that liberal progressive side of things does not go far enough for me. But I also understand, in my little simple way of understanding things, the difference between the Democrats and Republicans is not fundamental. Neither of them are going to challenge the empire. But the differences are incremental, but they're not inconsequential. And so what we were talking about tonight, these issues that Biden was looking into the camera and talking about tonight matter to those people sitting around the table in terms of bread and butter issues. We have to respond to that. I would also say that when we look at the Trump constituency, though I think many of them are people coming in for the last dying gasp of white supremacy, there's also some grievances there that were referred to in terms of neoliberalism and the consequences of globalization. We also have to address that. But that's a part of this our progressive agenda. We're the ones who have to build that. We're the ones who have to convince people to believe in our agenda sufficiently that we win. And so that's just how I see it.
Yeah. So, sorry, go ahead, please. Sorry.
No. I was just going to ask you. Well, no, you go ahead and respond, and then I'll ask you. You go ahead.
Just that, you know, the people who already agree, right? And the overwhelming majority of progressives are going to vote for Biden. In 2016, Bernie Sanders supporters voted for Hillary Clinton at twice the rate that Hillary Clinton supporters voted for Barack Obama in 2008, right? I don't think that's a real concern. For better or worse, I don't think that's a real concern. But if you really believe that Donald Trump is the existential threat that he is, if you sincerely believe that, and we're talking about how to court non-voters, my only appeal is that non-voters, for the most part, the kind of disaffected progressive, they understand the difference between Trump and Biden. What they don't understand is how they're going to ever end the pattern of constantly being put in this position and being asked to vote the lesser of two evils, neither which, as to your point, is responsive to the existential needs of our time. And I think that what would incentivize people to go ahead and vote would be, and I hope that maybe we can have a little bit of this discussion, to talk very specifically about what kind of organizing would exert the pressure needed to change the Democratic Party. Because what we saw this summer was the largest number of people in the street in American history protesting, and that it had absolutely no effect on Joe Biden's criminal justice platform, nor did it have an effect on his healthcare platform. In the midst of those protests, he said, even if the House and the Senate passed a Medicare for All bill, I would veto it. Nor did it have a good enough effect on his environmental platform, because experts, despite saying that they believe in science, experts point out that according to Joe Biden's plan, you're not going to avoid the 1.5 degrees Celsius change that we need to avoid the worst of the cataclysmic effects of climate change. So what do we do? What is going to change between now and 3 years from now that means that we are not being asked to do the exact same thing to prevent Tom Cotton or whatever monster that comes down the pike from getting into the Oval?
So no. let me comment on this, because
this
I want to
rich sort of dialogue.
This is super rich. So
I anticipated it would be. That's why I wanted to come on. Yeah, I'm a little different.
This is great. We got every generation in the house, I'm pretty sure, if I'm doing my math. So Brianna, what would you one answer to your question could be that we need to fight and change the Electoral College system. Right. That the popular vote is never going to give progressives the kind of, you know, platform centrality given the way the Electoral College functions. So one could say that this isn't just about our two choices, right, between one candidate and another, but rather the way we actually engage in the practice of voting. That's one thing. And the second thing is, I would say that there actually has been a pretty significant shift from even, you know, the previous election when Bernie and Hillary were very uncomfortable talking about race and trying to had Black Lives Matter activists had to sort of get them to say, you know, systemic racism. They were sort of stumbling over the term pretty dramatically. And then you see in all these debates that, you know, Biden, who's by no means a critical race theorist, is actually articulating the contours of systemic racism in his answer. So what do you say to those two responses?
Well, to the first point about the Electoral College, I think it's a valid one. But I'd also like to point out that it's been 20 years since we lost in 2000 because of the Electoral College, and the Democratic Party hasn't shown any sincere interest in actually pursuing any reform. So it's not clear to me that the powers that be are going to be invested in that particular reform. So I am going to just put that to the side for a moment. To your second point, I don't know that I would fully agree with the characterization of how Biden versus Hillary even were able to deal with the language around racial justice issues. I think Hillary Clinton was almost frustratingly adept at saying intersectionality and using the buzzwords that I think really assure a certain segment of the black pundit class and black, the academics that you see on TV all the time, but don't actually mean anything instead of systemic change. They've all gotten very good at saying systemic change. And then they turn around and say, law and order, we're not defunding anything. Don't worry, vote for me, John Kasich, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm much more interested in politicians, yes, like Bernie Sanders, and even like Julian Castro, who was willing to talk about qualified immunity, who was willing to talk about specific programs that were going to change outcomes for Black people. And sometimes I think having a greater facility with the language can be really, really dangerous because there's a lot of us who have been taught to care more about that kind of superficial ability to appeal to Black people, like Bill Clinton playing the saxophone, as opposed to substantively delivering material uplift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, that's entirely
very real. No, but it seems to me that, you know, we're never going to have unanimity, but we just try to tell the truth in that. So, I mean, if the neoliberal wing of the ruling class is the establishment of the Democratic Party, and Trump is the neo-fascist wing of the ruling class, and they both tied to Wall Street, they both tied to Pentagon militarism, they both tied to the same kind of imperial policies outside, and they're only going to use language for working people and people of color every 4 years, then the question is, yes, we make that very practical judgment, but at the same time, we got to tell the people the truth and say that the Democratic Party is not capable of embracing the needs of poor and working people. And when they do get a chance, they crush it. That's what the crushing of Bernie was all about. When Obama got on the phone and called his neoliberal friends and said, anybody but Bernie, then it was clear that's what the message was. You got to believe people when they act that way. But you still at the same time say, look, we don't. If fascism is going to call into question the very possibility of any democratic movements, you see. And that's why we got an anti-fascist vote. And that's a different kind of thing. That's why I'm agreeing in a certain sense with Brother Ron. But at the same time, I see what's just
good. Let's tangle. Let's tangle on that. Let's tangle a little bit on that. Let me just say a couple of things quickly. One of the things that we need to do, my sister, and I hope we can get to know each other better and work together on some things. We really need to also, we need reforms in the electoral system, not only the electoral college, but instant runoff voting or what they're now calling, I forget what they're now ranked calling, but we need ranked voting and so forth. Because we need to, I don't like to be in this position where people only have a choice between the Democrats and the Republicans. We need to get rid of that. Because I don't like this idea of saying that, you know, that the election was lost because people made a choice. They should be able to, you should be able to choose the candidate that you really believe in. And then you can go back and say, well, but I, you know, then I don't like this one so much, but I'd rather do this one than that one. That's the first thing. But the other thing, Professor, I got to challenge you on this. Now, you can say that there are these two wings and that one will never, ever deliver for the working class or for working people. So now the people who get in the streets and who fought for a living wage and a working wage and now are making $15 an hour, you know, for you to say to them, that what they understand is I was making $7 an hour. I'm now making $15 an hour.
But that ain't got nothing to do with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party came in kicking and screaming, brother. It
doesn't matter what the day did, kicking and screaming. They may have done it kicking. They may have done it kicking and screaming. They may have done it kicking and screaming, but the Republican Party didn't even scream. They blocked it, period. That's why they want the Supreme Court. They want to be able to use the Supreme Court to jam labor, all those things. Absolutely. So I don't say this disrespectfully. You're an ideological progressive. I'm a pragmatic progressive. But I don't take a backseat to anybody in terms of a whole sense of what my revolutionary bona fides are. Because we want the same objective. But I think there's a way in which we have to talk to the people. So the idea, it's just like, for example, I support the idea of defunding the police. But tactically, even the people who put it forth now are realizing that for lots of Black people, you scared the hell out of them. That was not the most sane use of terms. We should have come up with a different set of terminology, right?
Well, and that's our responsibility.
That is our responsibility, because Fanon says the people will teach you how to teach them. So if the people don't respond, it's easy for us to say, well, no, we have to learn how to use popular language. We have to learn how to build relationships. And I'll refer, you can, you know, get a chance, because all these issues, participation, engagement, not relying on the two parties. These are things that I've written about and talked about and believe in and will work on and continue to work on to my dying day. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to also message in a way that really grabs people and pulls them to us. And if our people are not grasping it and we grasp it, it is my responsibility to talk, sit down with the brothers and sisters and say, I understand your pain. I disagree too. But in this moment, we will do A. And at the end of the day, more than anything else, if we really believe in these ideas, it is on us to organize the people in such a way that we win. We have to win elections. If we can't win elections, then it's like, no, they can say, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin. We're just blowing smoke.
Brianna, I'm going to give you the last word because we only have a couple of minutes. So I'm going to,
We should extend this a little bit. This is really.
Oh, all right. Well, we now got more time.
We ain't had a chance. I haven't had a chance to see Professor West. We ain't had a chance to do no boxing in a while. You understand? Because I can't hardly reach you. You know, I'm glad somebody found out I had a telephone number. I'm just a little Negro out in the field trying to do a little good in the neighborhood. I don't know nothing about any of this stuff. Right? So I'm glad you reached out to me, brother.
Dr. Daniels, I would love to have you on my podcast as well, Bad Faith Podcast. But I just want to say that I think that pragmatism is often a term that's raised to talk about why we can't do more. And I understand that ideologically we're very much aligned. So I don't mean that in a derisive way at all. But the reality is the reason why Donald Trump has been able to push through so many of those judges and put us in the place that we are with respect to the Supreme Court and all the other federal courts in the land is partly because Chuck Schumer made a deal to fast track Trump's judges back in 2018, right? Defund the police, when the term first emerged, was polling relatively well and was getting stronger as we went from June into July, as there was a lot of public sympathy around the protests. And then when the tide began to turn in terms of the coverage, including all of our liberal newscasters on the mainstream media who started focusing on the violence and buying into right-wing narratives, that's when the polling began to turn. And when you look at things like Medicare for All, gay marriage, these were all issues that had support in the teens just 10, 5 years ago, and now which overwhelming majorities of Americans support. So I'm really reluctant to say that it's pragmatic not to be making the case for X, Y, and Z. And so much I think we do. So often we do real harm to our movement, being told, as I have been done over the past few weeks, to stay silent about the lies that Joe Biden has told about climate change, about healthcare. He said tonight, healthcare is a human right, and then proposed a plan that would, as he said in his words, protect the private health insurance industry. That's his interest. At this at a time when 12 million Americans have just been kicked off of their employer-based healthcare, and the COVID epidemic has revealed the frailty of that system. This is undoing the work that Bernie Sanders and others have done over the last 4 years to make it so that 88% of Democrats support Medicare for All. So what I put to you is, if Trump is an existential threat, if you need people to turn out in unprecedented numbers to really make sure he has a popular vote win and can't pretend to stay in the White House and exert his fascism in the way that we all know that he's poised to do, wouldn't it behoove Joe Biden to run on these overwhelmingly popular policies to get people to vote for him for good reasons instead of having to hold his nose and vote for him? And what role are we playing in ensuring that Democrats never actually have to listen to the will of the people by saying, you know what, we're going to vote for him no matter what? Now, I'm not talking about this election. I know this is a very sensitive subject and Donald Trump is really polarizing. So let's not talk about the context of 2020. But I want to know what's going to be different in 2023. What are we going to do tomorrow? What are we going to do November 4th that ensures that in 2023, I'm not being told, you know what, I know Joe Biden isn't great, is he in a second term? Or I know that Kamala Harris has a terrible history on criminal justice issues and she doesn't support Medicare for All anymore and all of these things, but we got to hold our nose because Tom Cotton is a fascist that is even more capable than Donald Trump. I want to know, and I want to know from activists and organizers and intellectuals like yourselves, because I don't know, I'm relatively new to politics. What do we do? Because people are tired of being told that it's going to be a hold or nose voting for the rest of their lives after they've been doing it for generations, and particularly in our community, have seen no material results.
I ain't holding my nose at all. I ain't holding my nose. Joe Biden is clearly the better choice. The other thing I want to say, Bernie Sanders, the Sanders campaign won. It was victorious. And this is why third party movements are effective throughout history, right? Because what they do is, and Lord, I've been praying for this, because I mean, you know, the Clinton stuff and all of these Republicrats and this kind of stuff, people talking about the center as if this is some kind of platonic concept. The center moves. It moves on the basis of movements. So Occupied Wall Street helped to move the death squad and get people to popularly understand in a way that they maybe have not never understood before what the 1% is all about. Problem is, the people from 1% were kind of a little leery about getting involved in this capitalist, political, messy political system so they could, you know, I mean, so we'll give them the victory there, right? The other thing that becomes important in terms of the overall conversation as well is that having won these victories, the onus still becomes on us to actually figure out how because look, for whether we like it or not, Biden won the Democratic primary. So as a candidate who won the primary, you know, and I know, you all know, there was some negotiations back and forth between the two parties and trying to make some concessions and so forth and so on. So no, he's running on his platform. And the case I'm trying to make is his platform is not my platform. And I'll openly say that to people. But I will say in the same breath, and I will take these issues issue by issue by issue, and I'll run down these issues as a report card, and I'll show you on every one of those issues how still this neoliberal wing of the fascist, whatever the deal is better than that antiquated Mussolini-type faction of the power structure, and why we need to therefore tactically, as mature organizers, put Biden in, and then it's on us. And I'll put that again. It is on us, therefore, to figure out how we then gain power, run people for elective office who, like the Charles Barons of the world and the Joanne Watsons and people like that, there are some out there, and democratic socialists who are winning. We got to continue to build those movements up until we are clearly the majority. That's my view of it. I'm not backing up in terms of saying because they are not this, therefore I am. No, I am saying because of the moment, we have to push forward, and we push forward with optimism and with encouragement and with inspiration, because we believe that in the end, our views, our values are going to triumph. And let me just say this. It's not a question of what you believe in. In some instances, how you say it. You can't sort of back up from that. You may have a correct idea, but articulate it wrong, like abolish the police. If you don't believe that a lot of Black people are not concerned with this notion of abolish police, then, you know, and that's the other thing. We have a tendency to have an incestuous conversation with ourselves. If we're talking to ourselves as radicals and politicals and nationalists and pan-African, oh yeah, we can say everything. We can be the most radical revolutionary people of all time. Test it with your mothers and fathers. Test it in the community. Test it in terms of what people believe. Take that feedback and say, oh my goodness, they do understand what I'm saying, but I need to change my language.
But the people can be misled, though, brother. The people can be misled. People can be misled by very, very slick and
But we're not going to mislead them, Professor West. We're not going to mislead them.
She gave the example.
We're not going to mislead them.
Look how Biden used the language of a right to human, the health care, and undercut the very policy that would deliver that. And the journalist didn't raise the question.
But I got to challenge you there, too. I still
got 20 million
there.
Who's on the outside.
I still challenge
it's
you
just
there.
A matter of the truth. So we can't just fall back on the people themselves. They get misled.
Right.
But Professor West, here's the deal that you seem to be just because for whatever reason you want to pass over. The fact of the matter is, I mean, I did not like Obamacare. I did not want something that, in fact, helped the insurance companies and the private.
We were together. We were together on that.
All right. So, but here's the deal. Here's what I'm trying to get you to see. Before Obamacare, there were X numbers of millions of people, 30 or 40 million or so, who had absolutely no health insurance. Yeah. I had health insurance. I can speak from that from a position of privilege. Say to those people who now have 30 million people who now have health insurance that somehow or another it was a mistake.
Oh, we're not saying that. No, we're telling the people that even after they get theirs, 20 million are still not going to have it.
That's why we have to continue to struggle. We have to continue to struggle to add more to it, right?
We struggle together on that, but you got to tell the people the truth.
But you do tell the people the truth.
Let's get back to the original.
We got the People's Party with Brother Nick and company, right? at the, trying to create some third force, third party on the outside, just like Brother Ron did the same thing with his third force on the outside, trying to put pressure on these two ruling class parties. And the same is true with reparations, right? If they can't come to terms with reparations, that's got to be pressure from outside. That's what we were just with Sister Shirley in California, with Marlana Karenga and Malefi Asante. They pushed that through on both fronts. They got both reparations investigation. Every class got to have now ethnic studies in every university because of Sister Shirley pushing that through from the assembly. And that's at the state level. That's not yet at the national level.
Well, yeah, I know about that now.
But that's crucial pressure from the outside.
We're in the forefront of the reparations speech now. But I know Sister Shirley.
I see what Sister Weber,
I'm saying.
Yeah,
we know all about that.
The thing is that the original disagreement, just to remind the two of you, the original disagreement was that you go to the people and the people help you shape the language as if they're the oracle. This is the part, Ron, that I think Cornell's critiquing, that your position is actually operating as if radicals need to change their language based on what everyday people already know who are or not vulnerable to being manipulated by ideology and by the subtle nuances. There is a generational shift that has happened in the political language around race and the use of narratives and stories that look like they're doing a certain kind of work when they're not doing that work at all. So when we were all much younger, you know, politics were clearer and in a sense more ethically on the face doing what they say they're going to do. That's really not what's happening anymore. And it's not just that black people, are, you know, not for abolishing the police in some general sense, because whenever you drill down and have a real conversation about what people really mean, then they say, well, actually, that I agree with. So it is not just about
drill down.
But that's our job.
That's what I'm saying.
It is really drill down, because what people are afraid of, what people are afraid of, Ron, is that they're going to be robbed and mugged in the street. And so on at first blush, that's a fair, legitimate concern. But then you say, well, look, why are people robbing? Why are people mugging? Where's the money going to go that might reduce that overall and produce greater safety in the community overall? So what I'm saying is that it's not a given that people will disagree. Basically the issue is just, you know, that they're the oracle and we need to adjust our politics. We might need to adjust our language. That I understand what you're saying,
but it's not that the people have the answer and radicals don't.
Well, also, it's our job. I'm not a politician. I'm not running for office. I don't think anybody else in this panel is either. And so I don't know why people like us are constantly having conversations about how to have the best language to win in Schenectady, as opposed to talking about how we can advance the conversation and help people who are turned off by abolish the police to understand better what it is. And so I don't want to take up airtime talking about how the language is bad when we could be using that airtime to clarify what is really meant in advancing the movement.
Well, I mean, that's what we do on the tightrope pretty much every week. We try to clarify the language.
I'm glad to be with y'all. But I also got to say, I am an organizer. Those of you who are listening, please, if you're interested in reparations, go to IBW21.org, right? That's the organizer. IBW21.org is where you can find my articles and essays. And I've written extensively on the question of a third force and independent politics. I have my own radio show on WBAI, WBAIs on the Pacific.
WBAI, Lord have mercy. I haven't heard that in a minute. But listen, I want to say one thing, Brianna.
And we've all learned much from Brother Ron's writing in newspapers all across the country and the world.
Finally, my book, still on this journey, The Vision and Mission of Dr. Ron Daniels. It took me...
Put it up a little higher. Put it up a little higher in the trenches. The word, though, brother.
Raise it up a little bit higher so we can see it.
There we go. But put it right in front of you and put it up a little high. There it is. That's it. All right. That's it.
All right.
Right on.
So anyway, I've enjoyed it.
I just, Brianna, there's one last thing I wanted to say, which, you know, might not be the most upbeat ending. So I'm going to let Cornell come up with something after that to bring us up, you know, and get us out of here on a happy note. But you know, when you say, somebody tell me where we're going to be in 3 years. You know, and you know, how do we know we're not going to be here over and over again? The answer to that is the very simple one-dimensional answer to that is we'll be here until we can dismantle the consciousness of white supremacy. We will be here. I believe that. In other words, we're not enough of the entire picture is such that we're trying to negotiate battles of positions we cannot even understand. Cornell and I talk about this on the show all the time. How could people think that Trump is in any way representing them, right? And how is he able to use the most incredibly racist language and then make claims and somehow people who don't see themselves as racist and vote for him? So to me, we're going to be in this place until we deal with that fundamental set of, you know, the power of those racial ideologies. Go ahead, bring it on.
Okay, well, Professor, I really respect and appreciate that. But if I can, my generational insight, and I'm the oldest millennial, you know, I'm 35 years old. I'm not exactly these kids in the street anymore. My point is this. We have been hearing that. And the specter of dismantling white supremacy, 400 years into this journey in this country, people want some assurance that their lives, not even their children and grandchildren, my generation, we gave up on the idea of children. Like I'm sitting here in the studio apartment and surveilling everything that I have in this world. You know what I mean? So what I want to know is concretely, and I say that not as a challenge, I say that because I have thoughts, feelings, and ideas, and I'm not an activist and I'm not an organizer. But I know that even I am frustrated when I talk to Black Lives Matter organizers and I ask them, I put them to them this question. You had millions of Americans in the street this summer who were arguing for an agenda that largely overlapped with, say, Bernie Sanders' agenda and which could be easily translated into concrete policy goals. Why was there not an effort to say, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton lost Pennsylvania by 20,000 votes. I have 20,000 signatures of registered voters in Pennsylvania that swear to sign up and vote for you, who didn't vote in 2016, but did vote in 2012. And they promise to vote for you if you adopt these criminal justice reforms that are ultimately popular, won't hurt your electoral chances, as everything I've discussed here today is a popular, majorities of Americans support them. Why isn't that kind of pressure, these kind of discrete targeted attacks aren't being implemented? Because I feel like there is a cloud, a cone of silence, a cabal that is preventing us from talking about these very radical, I think potentially very effective kind of interventions that unite activism and electoral politics in a way that could be deeply threatening to the Democratic Party. And the fact that Black Americans vote as this consistent block, and to your point, Professor West, the Democrats cannot survive without us, that we should be as a community having really serious conversations about how long we are going to pledge our votes to Democrats. And instead, we have our Black leaders out here talking about having, you know, withholding sex from Black men like 50 Cent until they stop talking to Donald Trump and all of this kind of nonsense. That's not where our minds need to be right now. And all I'm saying is there are things I believe we can do. I don't say, oh, you know, we don't have to dismantle white supremacy as a challenge or a rebuke. I'm saying that I think that there are tangible ways that we could change outcomes in 3 years, but people have to have the courage to do what is very politically toxic and unpopular, which is to say, no, even though I'm Black, even though I'm poor, even though I'm working class, I'm not going to vote for the Democrat no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the question fair. Is whether we want to, in that instance, be whether we want to be courageous or suicidal. Now, let me just say I'm serious about that. I'm gonna just shock you. If we said that to them and they didn't do anything in terms of Donald Trump, we got to get rid of Donald Trump. That's my position. Absolutely, there's no question about it. But here's something else I wanted to say, and this isn't, you know, maybe doesn't make much sense. But Professor West, and I'm sure Professor Rose, you remember this. Black people are pragmatic. They vote for the Democratic Party because on these bread and butter life and death issues, and even though they don't, they you know, and I'm one of them, I get upset with the way they do, they're still a better choice than this radical right-wing Republican Party. Now check this out. Now, Professor West and Professor Rose, and perhaps you, Joy, Sister Gray, remember when there was a Republican Party that had some of those progressive liberal elements of the power structure of the neo-fascists. I can't articulate it the way Professor West does, but he knows what I'm talking about, right? So in the city of New York, for example, you had Lindsay, you had Rockefeller ultimately get some very nasty thing, but you had a Rockefeller wing of the Republican Party. You had Case, Keating, all of these folks, which meant that Black folks could then say to the Democratic Party, no, we can go with Keating. We can go with Biden. We can go or we can go with Lindsey. But you see what happens now, the Republican Party took a sharp right turn. Today, to be a Republican is synonymous with being conservative or more conservative. So therefore, we're boxed in, right? Now, the way to break out of that box, we can have a whole show about how we got there. But the point is that Black folks are in a box because we're not going to jump out of the fire into the frying pan. That's the vast majority of people. So in this election, you know, we could say all we want to say. And by the way, there are some bills working their way through the Congress of the United States, the Floyd bill. That bill, it may not be all we would like for it to be, but that Floyd bill that's in the Congress of the United States was impacted by the movement in the streets. The John Lewis voting rights bill, which will in fact push back voter suppression, pushed by this reactionary Democratic Party, that will have some impact, giving us more leverage to move the movement forward.
But the impact on Joe Biden, the question I'm putting forward is whether Joe Biden influenced in his rhetoric or tone at all, given the movement, and he did not. And to your point about the Republican Party becoming more right, what happened was two things, that the Democratic Party chases it right at every instance. You don't see Republicans, you don't see Donald Trump out here courting moderate Democrats the way that Joe Biden's literally saying he's going to appoint Republicans to his cabinet. And second of all, I would say that the Tea Party exerted pressure on the Republican Party and said, we won't vote for you unless you listen to us. And they were willing to throw away an election. And the Republican Party ultimately had to respond in a way that it didn't really want to. And now it's more radical in a bad way than it was before. I'm not saying that the end result should be that we throw elections. I hope that our Democratic leadership cares enough about us that it would capitulate to our demands and be a better party. Now, that might be naive, given that we have two corporate parties and neither is especially interested in the fundamental needs of our community.
Yeah.
However, I would rather that be out in the open and exposed. Let's see that. Right. Let's reveal that truth for what it is, that we don't have people criticizing Bernie Sanders for talking about establishment politicians, pretending that every time he says establishment, he's talking about Black people and all of the other lies that circulated around the primary season, because we didn't have a media class that could keep the debate honest, and we didn't have representatives at a high enough level to really talk about the structural issues, the historical issues, and the fundamental capture, corporate capture of the party that puts us where we are today.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, this is so rich.
This really is. We were going to have y'all on again.
The dialogue has been so rich, but I think we have to begin.
Yeah, I thought we all going to do 15 minutes.
No. And this is my fifth podcast today, but y'all got me fired up like I don't know what. But we got to begin with the notion that we come from a great people who produce a great tradition. And the highest level in many ways of what we produced is a blues-like and jazz-like way of being in the world. See, the jazz-like pragmatism is different than opportunistic pragmatism. You see, so when Clinton and Biden, they use the language of being pragmatic. They ain't jazz-like at all. They opportunistic to the core. When Brother Ron used the word pragmatic, he's using a jazz-like quality because he still has a larger vision with a call for fundamental transformation. So the reform is steps on the way to keep alive the possibility for unleashing the revolutionary, subversive, intensely transformative possibilities. And we always have to remind ourselves of that, because we can't be jazz-like if we lose sight of the truth. We can't be jazz-like if we lose sight of what it means to empty ourselves and be of service to the people. And that's the benchmark of what it is. So even when we have our disagreements, that jazz-like improvisational swing-like quality got to be informing how we proceed with a respect for the people, but the people can be wrong. Mm-hmm. They could be wrong on transphobia. The church could be wrong on patriarchy. I mean, we got a whole host of ways in which we can wrong. We still love them, but because the love includes respect, protect, and correct. There ain't no love without correcting the people, but it ain't no love that's putting the people down. You learning from the people, just like a jazz person. You learn how to listen to play your horn, Mary Lou playing her piano, Coltrane blowing his horn. And that sets the real framework by how we deal with this catastrophe, because one thing we agree, we in a catastrophic situation. Ain't no doubt about that. No doubt about that. And that's why we on the tightrope. That's why it's a blessing to have you all. And you go, we got to bring y'all back, though, because this is rich.
Yes.
People need to hear this kind of exchange, because it's quality exchange, respectful exchange, transgenerational, and at the same time, so much of it is true.
So I'd love to have all of you on Bad Faith as well. This is exactly the kind of conversation we love to have on Bad Faith podcast. And you know, Dr. West, I know that we've already extended an invitation, but all three of you, I really enjoyed speaking with you all today.
Oh, absolutely.
It's been our pleasure. Indeed. Great to meet you. Thank you. Definitely. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you so much, Brother Ron. You know it's a blessing to set eyes on you, brother.
Same here.
Youngstown.
That's right.
All right. Thank you both. It was great.
Little small former steel town. That's all.
Excellent. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us on our election night. I'm already in the election. Our final presidential debate. Y'all can't keep me up this late. You know, my brain.
I'm telling you too.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, this before we say goodbye, that was really, really interesting. Really great.
That was so rich. It was so fascinating. Yeah. It really is. We got two powerful minds and spirits. And we started off with freedom fighters, you know, both of them.
Right. I think the other thing that really came through is that, you know, there's been a generational impact of the kind of corporatization of a Black political voice that wasn't present in the same way when we were 25 years old. That is to say, there's a whole class of people who purport to be representing Black interests or Black communities, but they're not doing it in the way that you were just describing, a jazz kind of, you know,
That's
listening
right.
to the community and really trying to represent and serve. And as a result, there's a level of cynicism and a lack of faith about this kind of pragmatic process that we might just see as a kind of nihilism when it's really not. It's that they're dealing with a different kind of betrayal.
That's exactly right. And hungry for the truth.
Right.
And hungry for the truth.
Right.
I mean, that's why I made that distinction between that jazz-like pragmatism and
opportunistic pragmatism,
because you got a whole lot of folk, including Black folk, who are just opportunistic in careers. Now, Brother Ron, he's not like that. He's actually a serious freedom fighter. That's why I wanted to separate his language from their language. But when the younger generation hears that language, they say, wait a minute.
Concession, right.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
They don't know, right. They don't. They see it as, right, I'm getting a book deal, you know, so I can tell my story for my own economic gain. Yeah, and that's not what he's doing. Yeah,
absolutely.
No, but that's an important distinction. I think we have to do more work on in our show and elsewhere on, you know, where we're talking, what we're saying, and how people are understanding that conversation, because we're bringing a different framework, a different generational understanding of who we're talking to and how we're having. It's like we're having a Black public sphere conversation in a world that's been integrated in the worst way, if you see what I mean, integrated in terms of taking away that relationship for conversation and service.
Very true. You know, Sister Brianna, though, she's been so courageous, though, because she's, you know, coming out of the Bernie Sanders campaign and holding on to her truth, and so many people coming at her, most of them misunderstanding. And so Ron was much more understanding in his own way, but so many people misconstrue what you're saying, and then they try to come at you in an unfair way, and she's been able to withstand that. Just 35 years old.
She's a formidable. Yeah, and I mean, she's got a real position that is worthy of serious consideration. This is not a fly-by-night casual response. It's trying to thread the needle. But I also took as a legit challenge that we need to, you know, do what we do. Since none of us are running for office, praise the Lord, because I couldn't make 5 minutes running. They would just run me out before I got in. You know, since we're not running, you know, I want to take up her challenge around helping to translate more. I mean, we do it with office hours, but I saw that as a, hey, you know what? That's right. That's something that we can really contribute, you know, to people not being as, you know, really unpacking how these ideas become unpopular, how people's fears are stoked, and how those translations are undone.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah. Well, but listen,
Lord,
it was great.
Mercy. We made it into 12:11. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
9 o'clock this morning to 12:11.
It's time for rest. We got to rest. You remember what Tracy Ellis Ross told us? You know, rest is resistance.
Oh, Lord, I forgot about that. That's true.
Yeah. So in her spirit, I am definitely going to get me. I'm going to be resisting my way all the way to bed right about now.
Lord, I'm going to do a little bit of reading. But other than that,
That's because, you've got more stamina than me. But anyway, it was great to be on with you.
It was wonderful, like always, to be in dialogue with you.
Rich.
Always a joy. And all three voices were wonderful today. But that last dialogue, I'm glad we just let it run because
yes, you were right. Yeah,
it was nice to just be able to wrestle with some of these issues, and I'm sure some people held on, and they'll hear it later on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. YouTube. It's important. This is at the heart of some of these issues that we really need to get to, not about who said what and what lies they told in the debate, but the debate opportunity, as a catalyst for these much more meaningful conversations that really govern what we're going to do in between these every 4 year, hellhole elections we seem to be stuck in. It's what are we going to do tomorrow? What are we going to do January 1st? What are we going to do for the rest of the time?
That's very true.
So,
Lord, well, I salute you.
All right. Thank you, Cornell. And thank you, everybody out there, tightrope fans. And thank you for staying up with us. And don't forget to share, subscribe, and hang out and visit us. And we'll see you next time on The Tightrope.
Hey, Tightrope family. This is Jeremy Berry, co-executive producer of The Tightrope Podcast. Dr. West, Professor Rose, and our team are excited to inform you about a special offer coming your way. On Tuesday, November 10th, the professors will be holding an exclusive live office hour segment of The Tightrope, and you can participate. Simply visit patreon.com/thetightropepod and join our new Patreon family, where we offer a more intimate connection to the professors through offerings such as the November 10th office hours. Both new and existing patrons are eligible to join, and you'll be able to submit questions and listen in on the dialogue between Dr. West and Professor Rose. A few patrons will even get to ask their questions directly and engage in a bit of dialogue with our esteemed host. Visit patreon.com/thetightropepod to join the family. We'll post details about the offer in the coming weeks. As always, stay strong and stay on the tightrope.